verses 10 through 12. Come now, therefore, and I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh, and that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? So he said, I will certainly be with you, and this shall be a sign to you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain.
Good evening. For those of you who have not been with us on our Sunday evenings, I've been doing a preaching through the Bible series on Sunday nights using the 17 time periods of biblical scholarship. And we have already gotten through before the flood. There we go. The flood, the scattering of the people, and the patriarchs. And now we're going to be getting into the Exodus. And as we get into the Exodus, we have a much closer timetable as we go through things. So we'll be able to start pulling out, as other people have asked me to do. I will try to do this from here on out. But there is some contemporary history that we can also view just perhaps briefly to get some historical context. Right now, what we're going through is as we are leaving Egypt, it's going to be about 1450 BC, and there's just not really a whole lot going on there. The first actual battle of Armageddon, the Battle of Megiddo between Tutmosis III and the King of Kadesh and his cabal, happens here in 1450. I think it's actually technically 1451. And then this is also when the Minoan culture completely falls apart because they are attacked and destroyed as a civilization. So not too much of history that people know about, but as we get further along in history, we'll be able to start recognizing names as we go through. For instance, the one that always throws people is when we start getting to Isaiah. Isaiah is 100 years after Homer wrote the Iliad. And that's not something we generally think about. We think about Isaiah as being way before that, typically. But that's what we'll start to find as we go through some of this contemporary history as well, just to give ourselves a little bit of context. But here with the Exodus, what we're going to be covering is since we've been splitting this up into each one is in multiple parts, at least two parts, our Egyptian captivity, our part of the Exodus that we're going to be examining goes from, well, the Exodus itself is Exodus 1 to Numbers 14. Numbers 14 is where God gives the final moment here where they're going to start the 40 years of wandering, okay? So this is what we're looking at, but what we're going to focus on is we're going to try to get through the Red Sea. And normally what I've been doing is I have been sort of outlining the entire context and kind of hitting that, but I'm going to start doing something a little bit differently starting tonight. We're just going to pick out some key moments and examine them. So if you'll start with me in Exodus chapter 2, and we'll look at verse 6. So what we find in chapter 2, verse 6, is that Moses is born at the beginning of the chapter, and Amram and Jochebed send Moses down the Nile and in a basket, but it's found by the princess, by Pharaoh's daughter. And it's interesting that if anybody knew the commands that Pharaoh had given throughout the land, it would be the princess. And the boys are supposed to be killed. That was the whole deal about chapter 1. And at the very end of chapter 1, Pharaoh sort of updated it because there were some midwives that were going against his will. So at the end, he said, every son who is born, you are to cast into the Nile, and every daughter you're to keep alive, because he's afraid of the Israelites. Well, here it says in verse 6, when she opened it, she is the princess, and it is the basket that Moses is in. She saw the child, and behold, the boy was crying, and she had pity on him and said, this is one of the Hebrews' children. So clearly, Pharaoh doesn't even have his own family in on the plan, I guess, because she decides to keep one of the boys who's supposed to be killed alive. And not only that, goes and gets, who we find out later is Jochebed, to take care of him. So this is sort of the first real moment here, besides him being put in a basket, that we see anything out of Moses. But in chapter 2, verse 15, here is where we see that Moses has killed an Egyptian in verse 12, and he flees to Midian. Okay, and before I get too much further, he goes to Midian at about 40 years old. Okay, and he's not going to come back and help the people leave until he's about 80. So what we're looking at is at chapter 2, verses 1 through 6, we're looking at about 1530 BC. Okay, and now here, as he flees to Midian, we're looking at about 1490 BC. So here he escapes to Midian. When Pharaoh heard of this matter, which is where he killed an Egyptian that was abusing a Hebrew, because this is where we start finding out that Jochebed has helped Moses understand who he is. When Pharaoh heard of this matter, he tried to kill Moses, but Moses fled from the presence of Pharaoh and settled in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. Now the priests of Midian had 7 daughters, and they came to draw water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. Then the shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. When they came to rule their father, he said, why have you come back so soon today? They said, an Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds, and what is more, he even drew the water for us and watered the flock. He said to his daughters, where is he then? Why is it that you have left the man behind? Invite him to have something to eat. Moses was willing to dwell with the man, and he gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses. Then she gave birth, and he named him Gershom, for he said, I have been a sojourner in a foreign land. That's what Gershom means, is a stranger. Okay. And so then we see that the king of Egypt dies, and things get worse for Israel after that. So here in this escape to Midian, he meets a priest. That's what it calls him, the priest of Midian. Here he's named Reuel, but we know him by another name, Jethro. And so not only does he meet the priest of Midian, he marries Zipporah and has a son before we get to chapter 3. So this is sort of where we are after he's been in Midian for some time. And this is where verse 1, here is where we sort of change the name to Jethro. Now Moses was pasturing the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. Okay, so he is in Midian, and this is where we have the burning bush. Again, this is an episode in our Bibles that even non-believers tend to know. There's a few of these scattered throughout the Bible that non-believers will oftentimes know. But here in this bush, here's where it says in verse 2, the angel of Yahweh, the angel of the Lord, appeared to him in a blazing fire from the midst of a bush, and he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, yet the bush was not consumed. And I find this image an interesting one, Because there are times where God is called a consuming fire. However, the fire that we see here is not one of destruction. It is simply one of illumination. The bush is burning, but it's not being burned up. And this is a strong metaphor, I think, for what is to come. That there is going to be this fire, and yet it's not a fire of consuming, it is a fire of illumination and preservation. And I think this is the metaphor of what Moses is going to be here soon. But we'll see how the metaphor takes on a different image as we look into how Moses' reappearance in Egypt affects Egypt. And of course, this is a marvelous thing. Verse 3, Moses said, I must turn aside now and see this marvelous sight, why the bush is not burned up. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, here I am. Then he said, do not come near here. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. That's one of those verses I'm always going to remember. I was taught a song growing up about taking off our sandals because there is holy ground here. But this idea of reverence is, of course, ubiquitous about God. But it's interesting that Moses is asked to remove his sandals when this idea of coming, he's been looking for his sheep. This is not the time to take your shoes off. This is the time to keep looking for your sheep. But that's not what Moses is concerned about. And this is going to end up being important for the priests later on as well, and their dress. But before we get there, because we will get there eventually, he said also, verse 6, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Then Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. You've already been looking at it. If God was going to strike you down, I think we would have already done it. But here he is showing appropriate reverence. Okay. The Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have given heed to their cry because of their taskmasters, for I am aware of their sufferings. So I have come down to deliver them from the power of the Egyptians and to bring them up from that land to a good and spacious land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanite and the Hittite, the Amorite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite. Now behold, the cry of the sons of Israel has come to me. Furthermore, I have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians are oppressing them. And then there's going to be a further conversation that Moses has with the Lord. And when we start in verse 4, we really start to see, at first he just kind of has some general questions like chapter 3, verse 13, when they say to me, what is his name? What do I say your name is? And this is where we see, I am who I am, which is what we call the tetragrammaton. That word comes from this Hebrew word that in your Bibles is often all caps with smaller capped letters, capitalized letters, is four letters in Hebrew. We don't exactly know how to pronounce it. The best idea is Yahweh, but this is where we get Jehovah, is we take those letters, which in English is YHWH, and then we put the verbs for Adonai, the Hebrew word for Lord, and that's where we get Yehovah, which is where we get our Jehovah. So this is the name that he gives him. Say, I am, Yahweh has sent me to you. But he's just been sort of talking with the Lord, but now in chapter 4, verse 1, it takes on a different tone, Moses' questions. In fact, they start seeming more like excuses. Moses said, what if they will not believe me or listen to what I say? For they may say, the Lord has not appeared to you. The Lord said to him, what is that in your hand? And he said, a staff. Throw it on the ground. So he threw it on the ground and it became a serpent. And Moses fled from it. But the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand and grasp it by its tail. So he stretched it out by his hand, caught it, and it became a staff in his hand, that they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to you. And then he gives him another sign of putting his hand in his bosom, and then it comes out and it's covered in leprosy. And then he puts it back in his cloak and pulls it back out and it's restored. And he says, if they will not believe the first sign, then they can believe the second. Then in verse 10, we have another question from Moses, or perhaps, again, an excuse rather than a question. Please, Lord, I have never been eloquent, neither recently nor in time past, nor since you have spoken to your servant. I am slow of speech and slow of tongue. Again, if you're going to be the spokesman for God, it's not the most invalid reason to be thinking about. I'm not a good orator. But again, you're looking at the Lord. The Lord can do great things. And surely giving you the words to say is not outside of the realm of his possibility. But the Lord said, who has made man's mouth? Or who makes him mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now then go, and I will be with you. But he said, verse 13, please, Lord, now send the message by whomever you will. That's what he's trying to do, Moses. He's trying to send the message by whomever he will. And you are bucking. You're kicking against his goad. But then in verse 14, the anger of Yahweh, of the Lord, burned against Moses. And he said, is there not your brother Aaron the Levite? I know he speaks fluently. And moreover, behold, he is coming out to meet you. When he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. And so he tells him, you tell him what to say then. And he'll say it for you. And this is the plan that we put into action. Here comes Moses out of Midian to come and release the people from Egyptian captivity with his brother as the spokesman. And then we'll skip down to chapter 7. So from chapter 7, verse 14, to chapter 11, verse 10, we're going to see the plagues that come upon Egypt because Pharaoh will not let the people go per God's orders. And interestingly enough, these, if you look at Egyptian mythology and its pantheon, is a lot. It's very complicated. Lots of people go with other people, and it can get really muddy after a while. Some gods do the same thing. I think the only one that sort of rivals it in complexity is the Hindu religion. But it's very difficult to sort of get a full idea of Egyptian deities. But when you look at the 10 plagues, what I tried to do here was give you a sense of some of the major deities at this time. And we're pairing them up with different plagues that God brings upon Egypt. And that's really what God is doing here. What he's trying to do is he's trying to get Pharaoh to understand, you think you're going to stop me. You think you're going to thwart what I want to do. But you forget, I am the Lord. And that's another reason why God names himself that way. I am. No other deity is, but he is. And so here, when we look with the water to blood, we see that both the god Hapi and the god Osiris are both representative of Nile, especially when the Nile floods over. That's a common thing that happens almost yearly, and provides the ground with good growing soil. It places silt along the banks of the Nile. And so both of these gods, you'll see Osiris come up quite a bit. He's sort of a major player throughout the vast majority of Egyptian mythology. And then when we get to the second plague of frogs, there was a god named Hehet, and Hehet was known for being being depicted as a frog. And so many frog, whenever you saw a frog, you assumed it was the god Hechet. But here they come out of the Nile and spread around it. It says that when they finally stop, when God finally relents with the frogs, they don't go away. They just pile up and things get nasty, right? And again, your God is nothing because I'm leaving him to rot around your nation. And then we see, depending on your translation, yours might just say insects, or it might more specifically say gnats or lice. And this is probably along the lines of the god Set or Seth. He was the enemy and brother of Osiris, but he was the surrounding desert around the fertile line of the Nile. Was sort of seen as Seth's domain. And along the Nile was Osiris's domain, as well as the underworld. And so they were rivals. But it says that out of the dust came these gnats or these lice. And so that's where there's not really a gnat god, but where I think we're getting more to the idea of Seth here. And then the two of them together is where I think the idea of the flies are coming from, because this is where we see that it gives Pharaoh and his house a particularly bad time to have these flies at the end of chapter 8. It says, into the house of Pharaoh, verse 24, and the houses of his servants, and the land was laid waste because of the swarms of flies in all the land of Egypt. So I pulled these out here because these are both well known as being the gods of the king. They both, even though they were rivals, they both supported whoever was Pharaoh, which is really helpful that two of your most powerful gods are fully in support of your rule. Very, very helpful. Then when we get to the disease and death of the cattle, there's two here, Bot and Hesat. And these are both cow deities, not just in image, but also that all of the cattle were seen as being their representatives, which is interesting because being the shepherds and the farmers of these cows was seen as sort of the lowest job in all of Egypt, but they were still revered as being gods and goddesses of the land. Then when the boils come, I think this one is mostly in line with Horus. The god Horus was known as being responsible for a lot of things, but primarily the health of the Egyptian people. So God takes away Horus's power and strikes them with an affliction. And then with hail, Aker and Neper. So I'll explain Neper here in a moment, but Aker is one of the gods of the sky. And we'll talk, there's others as well that we'll get to here in a moment. But also here in the plague of hail is that it mentions toward the end of the chapter, verse 31, the flax and the barley were ruined, for the barley was in the ear and the flax was in bud, but the wheat and the spelt were not ruined, for they ripen late. So God is showing this choice over the crops of the land. Well, Neper is the deity for vegetation and crops. Okay, and then the work of Osiris and Bot and some of these other ones, they serve what Neper does. So he sort of hits two in one with the hail here. And then with locusts, Isis is another one. She is the queen to Osiris. He's the king of the Egyptian deities. Isis is the queen. And she is also in charge of making sure. So Neper keeps the vegetation, but Isis protects the vegetation. So I could have put her up here as well. But here the locusts come and eat the other vegetation. But again, through all of these, and including the darkness here, these all affect only Egypt and not Israel. Okay? These all here, and I could have added Isis, I just didn't have enough room. And I also could have added Osiris. Again, a lot of these gods will kind of pull double, triple, quadruple duty. But all of these are gods of the sky and the sun. And Horus has some of that as well, but he is god of the sun and the moon. So I added him on the end there. But these three others are the gods of the sky, and particularly the gods of light and of the sun. And so God shows his superior over them by removing that light when it's supposed to be at its brightest, and the land is plunged into darkness. But then this last plague, as we have noted before, is where Israel is included. And I would say this death of the firstborn, these were the three that are probably the most powerful and the most in line with the lesson that God's providing. But I could have chosen almost every god on this list that would have needed to respond to the problem in some way to overcome whatever God's work was, if they were real. But these three, and again, part of the reason why I added Set here is, again, because when you have the god of gods, the king of the gods, and his brother, and they're both in charge of supporting the Pharaoh and keeping him safe, well, this plague does not leave the Pharaoh untouched. And then, of course, the god of death, Osiris is the god of the underworld, but the god of death and of leading people to the underworld is Anubis, and his reign and authority is certainly questioned by the work of the Lord as well. And so what he's doing is he's showing Pharaoh, do you really think you stand a chance with your gods against me? And of course, throughout this, Pharaoh keeps saying, yeah, I think so. And sometimes he'll relent and then, hold on, I changed my mind. Deal's off. Well, eventually we get here, and by this 10th plague, the Pharaoh is broken. And then we see, as the people leave Egypt, because remember I said all of the nine plagues at the start left Israel untouched, but then we see the death of the firstborn is one that could have come to Israel if they had not been obedient. And it doesn't tell us that there were any that disobeyed, but if they had disobeyed, the angel of death would have come for them as well. The destroyer would have come for them. Well, in the beginning of chapter 12, we see that there is the installment of Passover just before they're actually going to start leaving in verse 33. And then at the end, in verse 51, then they have officially all left Egypt. But here we establish Passover. And we're going to go back and talk about Moses again briefly, and how he is an archetype of Jesus. But let's talk about the Passover here for a moment. Verse 3, speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, on the 10th of this month, they are each one to take a lamb for themselves according to their father's households, a lamb for each household. If the household is too small for a lamb, he and his neighbor nearest to his house are to take one according to the number of persons in them. According to what each man should eat, you are to divide the lamb. The lamb shall be an unblemished male, a year old. You may take it from sheep or goats. You shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month, and the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel is to kill it at twilight. Moreover, they shall take some of the blood, put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the house in which they eat it. They shall eat the flesh that same night, roasted with fire, with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. Do not eat any of it raw or boiled at all with water, but rather roasted with fire, its head, its legs, along with its entrails. You shall not leave any of it over until morning, but whatever is left until morning, you shall burn with fire. You shall eat it in this manner, with your loins girded, sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand, and you shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. So I want to point out a few things here. Obviously, this is Passover, which is the institution of the Lord's Supper that Jesus brings at the twilight of his life. But I wanted to point out a few things here. The first is your lamb shall be an unblemished male, which is exactly what Jesus was. An unblemished male. A year old. This is a very young animal. And Jesus, in the grand scheme of things, was a very young man. It's one of those weird moments that I'm coming to in my life, around the age that Jesus was performing his ministry. And I knew Jesus was young, but never have I felt him so young as now living through it. So he's only a year old. And then the congregation of Israel is to kill it at twilight. And it just made me think of them trying to pull the body of Jesus down before the Sabbath began. And how darkness was over the land in the afternoon, and their time is of the essence. The new day is about to begin at twilight. Moreover, they shall take some of the blood, put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the houses in which they eat it. They are, in a way, macabre decoration of the blood of Christ, but that's exactly what we're doing. By being baptized, washing our sins in his blood, we are putting blood on the doorposts of our temple to keep out the destroyer. And then they are to eat it as though they are ready to go, because where they are is not where they belong. They're going somewhere else. And we are to be pilgrims and sojourners in the land where we are. And we'll go back to Moses again, as I said. We'll go back to him in a moment. But then in chapter 13 and verse 7 is where we see God take the lead here. I said chapter 13 and verse 7, and that is incorrect. And I'm not sure what verse I was referring to. Give me a moment. There we go. 17 is what it should have been. When the Pharaoh had let the people go, God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines, even though it was near. For God said the people might change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. Hence, God led the people around by the way of the wilderness to the Red Sea. The sons of Israel went up in martial array from the land of Egypt. And so here God begins leading them. And then we get to chapter 14. Chapter 14, this is where the rubber meets the road for the Israelites. Yes, they have already shown their belief in the Lord, their obedience in his charge by taking their lambs and doing everything according to God's plan. But then as they're nearing the Red Sea, it says, as the Egyptians were chasing them, verse 10, as Pharaoh drew near, the sons of Israel looked, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they became very frightened. So the sons of Israel cried out to the Lord. That in and of itself is the right thing to do. When you see that there's a problem, who should you cry out to? The Lord! But the problem is what they cry out. They said to Moses, is it because there were no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us in this way, bringing us out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we spoke to you in Egypt, saying, leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness. What's the problem with that statement? What did God just do for you? God just showed his superiority over the strongest nation on the entire planet at this stage in history. And every bit of archaeological evidence we have found supports this notion. Even if there were other empires in other parts of the world that never met the Egyptians, they still had superiority. And here, God just decimated them. You think God led you out into the wilderness just to kill you? Moses said to the people, "Do not fear. Stand by and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you have seen today, you will never see them again forever." Talk about bold. The Lord will fight for you while you keep silent. And then the Lord is going to speak to Moses. "Why are you crying out to me? Tell the sons of Israel to go forward. As for you, lift up your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it. And the sons of Israel shall go through the midst of the sea on dry land." God does this to Moses a couple of times where he looks at him and he says, "What are you looking at me for? I gave you power to lead these people." But he gives him an instruction anyway. "Lift your staff, stretch your hand over the sea, and divide it." And that's exactly what happens. Moses, verse 21, stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord swept the sea back by a strong east wind all night and turned the sea into dry land. So the waters were divided. He didn't just split the sea. He made sure that there was ground that Israel could travel on. The sons of Israel went through the midst of the sea on the dry land, and the waters were like a wall to them on their right and on their left. And if you're not catching on that this is a metaphor for baptizing the people, then maybe we need to put on glasses. That's exactly what God is doing here. But God's not done. God lets the Egyptian army go and chase after them. The Lord said to Moses, verse 26, "Stretch out your hand over the sea so that the waters may come back over the Egyptians, over their chariots and their horsemen." So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its normal state at daybreak while the Egyptians were fleeing right into it. Then the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. The waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen and the Pharaoh's entire army that had gone into the sea after them. Not even one of them remained. But the sons of Israel walked through on dry land through the midst of the sea. The waters were like a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. When Israel saw the great power which the Lord had used against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses. I wish it just stopped right there. And then they made it to the promised land and everything was good. But it's not where it's going to end. But it is where we're going to stop for this evening in our Bibles. I wanted to go back and think about Moses for a moment before we get into our practicality. I must not have saved a slide. I had a nice slide for you, but I'll just cover what it was that I was going to talk about. When we think about Moses, especially so far with the people, there's a few similarities that we can see with Moses being an archetype of Jesus. The first is that Moses comes out of circumstances where there are those seeking his life even as a baby. The motives might be a little bit different, but the intent is ultimately the same. And then to be pulled out eventually out of Egypt and going into another land, that again is very much what Mary and Joseph and Jesus did. "Out of Egypt I called my son," a fulfillment of prophecy there. And then after a time in Midian, for him it was 40 years, For Jesus, it was 40 days in the wilderness. And there, Moses and Jesus accomplished what they needed to do before starting their real work. And Moses comes out to lead the people. Jesus comes out having overcome Satan and temptation and sin and led the people through ministry, through teaching them about the imminent kingdom of God. And then Moses is going to lead them to the promised land. The difference here is that Jesus gets to go and prepare the promised land, and Moses didn't get to go into it. But they lead the people out of their slavery, out of their bondage, which is what Jesus does for the righteous and the obedient. Let's look at some ideas of practicality here before we finish. First, during everything that we read, God has always been in charge. God has always been aware. God has always been in control. And there are times where it doesn't always feel like it, but that's the beautiful thing about our feelings. Our feelings don't have to be true. Our feelings can say one thing while God is working another. God is always in charge, even if you don't feel it. Secondly, God foretold this back in Genesis chapter 15. He told Abraham, look around you. I will give this to your children, but they're going to have to be in captivity in another land for 400 years. 400 years is what God tells Abraham. And then in Exodus, it tells us 430 years to the day that Israel was put under Egyptian bondage and slavery is when they leave Egypt. So still right along with God's prophecy to Abraham. God is the true God. No other gods can compare. Whether we're speaking about pagan deities or I put here immaterial, what I mean by that is the gods that we serve today. The gods that we serve today are ourselves. Hollywood and its celebrities. Our TV, our phones, our computers. Perhaps our nation. Anything that we decide is more important or has precedence over God, no other God compares to our God. And you must put him first. And God will protect his people. He may not protect us from physical problems like he kept the plagues from Israel, but he does promise us that we can be protected from the devil if we rely on him. We rely on his word. Yes, we still stumble, but God is protecting us, doesn't allow us to be tempted beyond what we are able, 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13. And lastly, the last practical lesson here before it's yours and we wrap up. Either you're Israel or Egypt, there is no in between. You're either a child of his or you aren't. It's not a fine line. It is a very broad line drawn in the sand. And you will either be protected and sustained by God or you will be decimated by him. And it is up to you to decide. I heard a preacher say this once. He said, everyone on the day of judgment will be on their knees in front of the Father. You can either kneel or be forced to your knees. And that's the choice you have right now. Because I don't know how much time you're going to be granted after this. I could not be done with this sentence before the Lord comes back and judgment comes. But one thing I do know about the Lord is he gives us second chances and third chances and millionth chances. And he gives you time. And he gives us patience. But that patience is not eternal, not because it couldn't be eternal, but because there are other aspects of God's character that do not allow them to be eternal. That there will come a time in which his patience will be cut off. It won't run out, but it will be cut off. And it is a time for judgment. But if you are Israel and you have painted the blood on the doorway of your soul, then there's nothing to worry about on the day of judgment because you've been a child of his. And being a child of his means we always have an advocate with the Father, that we can go to our Father through Jesus whenever we need his help, whether it's asking him for forgiveness, whether it's asking him for help to get through trying times, we always have Jesus as long as we read in James this morning in our Bible class, we draw near to God. And he will draw near to us. But it all starts with being washed in the blood. And if that's not what you have done by this point in your life, now is the time. And don't worry, it's not a bucket of blood we have in the back. It's water. But it's representative of the blood of your Savior, Jesus. And instead of staining you, it will wash you clean. But if we have already immersed ourselves in his blood, perhaps we need to be reminded of what that price was and come back to him and serve him, make our lives right with him. If that's what you need, please take advantage of this opportunity as we stand and as we sing.
Have you been to Jesus for the cleansing power? Are you washed in the blood of the Lamb?